Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Plato understood the philosopher, famously, as the lover of wisdom, and he built his academy for students who wanted to pursue that. My question tonight is about the object of the philosopher's eros, and whether that object is only for the philosopher. After all, philosophers are pretty weird people. I think we have to be upfront about that. Or whether we should all strive to love wisdom, and if so, why we should do this. And in particular, I am very interested in whether the university itself, like Plato's Academy, ought to be dedicated to the pursuit of wisdom. Isn't it enough that we are dedicated without fear or favor to truth, or so we like to say? What is wisdom, anyway? And why is it that in most universities today, you will never meet a faculty member or student who thinks they ought to be pursuing it or has any idea what it is? So I want to try to approach this question by way of contrasting two very different visions of what sort of knowledge is essential to the university, right? The first is that promoted by someone named Max Weber, maybe you've heard of him, and the other is promoted by Cardinal John Henry Newman, who is now, alongside Thomas Aquinas, a doctor of the church, yay. I will then move on to discuss Aquinas and conclude with some thoughts about what is at stake in the debate between these two men and how it affects our understanding of a liberal education. So how does that help us answer the question, why are we here? What are we doing? Okay, so Weber first. So in 1917, the great sociologist Max Weber was invited by a group of university students in Munich to launch a lecture series on intellectual work as a vocation. The students were members of a group called the Free Student Alliance, and this was a group that championed the idea of liberal education as the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, coinciding with moral education, or what the Germans call Bildung, and academic freedom. And they were championing this during a time when these ideals were under tremendous pressure from different forces: disciplinary specialization, state interventions, market pressures, and a world war. So addressing about 100 students in a lecture hall, Weber delivered an address that was surely deeply unwelcome to them. Rather than give a defense of their lofty ideals of liberal learning, which I'm pretty sure he was invited to do, Weber gave an account of scholarship as mere expertise, undertaken with no ultimate horizon of meaning or purpose. So Weber embeds his conception of scholarship within his more general diagnosis, and this is what he's very famous for, his general diagnosis of modernity as a period of disenchantment. So I'm going to quote Weber. "Increasing rationalization and intellectualization means that in principle, there are no mysterious and calculable forces intervening in our lives, but instead, all things can be mastered through rational calculation. It means the disenchantment of the world." Now, it's constitutive of Weber's concept of disenchantment, as it is constitutive of modernity, as he understands it, that we exert a kind of Baconian mastery or rational control over nature and thereby over our own lives, right? We're master of our domain in some significant degree. But I want to note that the German word for enchantment for Weber is literally connected to magic. A literal translation of the German he uses might be demagication, right? So whatever is magical on Weber's view is whatever cannot be shoehorned into the ontologies, epistemologies, or calculative rationalities of the natural and the social sciences. And what Weber would have understood as the natural and the social sciences are the exact same thing, that we would understand them today. In fact, he's considered to be one of the great forefathers of sociology as a social science. Now, the modern university is an institution, Weber argues, that inevitably reflects this sort of basic condition of modernity, and it must dictate what sort of knowledge it is legitimate and valuable to pursue in the university. So it's within this larger framework of the conditions of modernity that Weber presents an account of scholarship as mere expertise, right? So again, in the present era, what primarily shapes the psychology of anyone who pursues an academic calling is the fact that scholarship in both science and the humanities has entered an apparently permanent phase of specialization, unlike any that has taken place before. We can feel sure as academics that we have achieved something of genuine scholarly value only if we have specialized to the utmost degree possible. So the scholar is a professional expert who sort of narrows his vision, right, according to what is most highly specialized, and in the service of self-understanding and to increase our repository of objective facts. Weber is emphatic that it is not, and this is another quote, a gift of grace with seers and prophets dispensing holy objects and revelations, nor a part of sages and a philosopher's meditations on the meaning of life. Real scholarship, Weber argues, leaves totally unasked questions of meaning and value. This ought to be left to the priests and the prophets, but it is certainly not the business of the scholar. Questions of ultimate meaning and value are outside of any possible expertise and thus have nothing to do with scholarship or the university. So Weber yokes the notion of scholarly work to a technical notion of progress that is incremental and also without end, like it's just going to keep going, this scholarly progress. And he's working with an ideal of progress in which future knowledge does not really build on the foundation of the past, but actually makes the past obsolete. And Weber seems to be taken by the conviction, totally unargued for, that scholarly knowledge will always march forward in progress, only looking behind itself insofar as this is necessary for looking ahead. Tradition, obviously, on this view, carries with it no interesting or special authority or value. It is deeply unclear why anyone would study Aristotle, for example, beyond seeking expertise in intellectual history, and obviously that will only be a rare sort of breed who pursues that. It's also essential to Weber's definition of progress, scholarly progress, that has no ultimate horizon, right? So there are no transcendent norms like truth or goodness or beauty. So that kind of raises the question, okay, well, what is the real value of scholarly work, right? And Weber's answer is interesting, and it has three parts. First, it gives us more techniques for controlling our lives. Two, scholarship gives us methods of thinking that are internal to disciplinary knowledge, right? So it sharpens the mind to some extent. Three, scholarship gives clarity about the means to whatever ends we've actually adopted, either as individuals or as a society. But what scholarship emphatically does not and should not do is tell us which ends we should pursue. To render a judgment of value, Weber says, would be demagoguery, an abuse of power by the scholar in front of his hapless students. This is the inevitable result, he argues, of the forces of disenchantment, which create a situation in which the ultimate and most sublime values have retreated from public life and are merely a matter of private personal choice, right? Like, you work that out for yourself. Now, one question that presents itself here is, Well, okay, what sort of disciplines can count as Wissenschaft or scholarship on Weber's model? Well, one thing that Weber is very helpfully clear about is that theology is absolutely forbidden, right? Because it violates the terms of modernity as he has outlined them, and therefore it can be no part of a modern university, right? So here's Weber again. All theology is an intellectual rationalization of religion's sacred domain. Every theology presupposes that the world must have a meaning and asks how to interpret this meaning so that it is graspable by the mind. That is its basic sin for Weber. And Weber seems to suggest that he would be totally fine with some sort of department of religion, perhaps like my own department, philosophy and religion, so long as it does not go further than describing what various world religions have said, right? So you can sort of just canvas the options. The Catholics said this, the Jews said that. It's all very interesting. But the problem with theology is that it will want to do more than this, right? The problem with theology is that it will try to argue that these things are true and coherent and worth believing. And the thing that really sort of irritates Weber about theology is the thing that Aquinas thinks is kind of so rad about it, which is that the first principles of theology are in fact articles of faith, right? They are matters of revelation. And that is not acceptable for Weber, because these premises about what Weber calls sacred facts are plainly outside the realm of rational knowledge as Weber has narrowly defined it. So theology is out. I think to a certain extent, and I've written about this in different contexts, but I think in a way we're all Weberians now in the university, because our universities more or less force us into this mold. Universities now understand themselves as in the knowledge production business. So if you want to look at how universities are ranked in the Carnegie system, it's going to be based on research outputs and dollars to a significant extent. And this knowledge production is understood in terms of discrete, isolated, quantifiable outputs. And if you want to get tenure or promotion in a university, you need to publish in venues that do demand hyper-specialization, right? Ensuring that professors remain more or less in disciplinary silos. Even undergraduate education is now merely a prologue to specialization and professionalization, since its measure of success is all too often its effectiveness in preparing students for a job or for admission to graduate or professional schools, rather than whether they are prepared to live meaningful lives or take up the duties of citizenship. So another thing that I want to argue is that this Weberian model, right, of the sort of knowledge that we're seeking in the university fits very poorly with my own discipline of philosophy. Unfortunately for the philosopher, we're not really scientific experts. The value of philosophical reflection on being or knowledge or the good is therefore increasingly opaque to the denizens of the university. Perhaps it is opaque even to ourselves. Long gone are the days when philosophers are willing to speak of themselves as striving for wisdom. Philosophers produce their research outputs like everyone else, and hope that by the gratuitous grace of those with institutional power over them, they will be allowed to carry on with their intellectual labors, which normal people completely ignore. But that grace is often not extended, right? This institution murdered its philosophy department in 2019, although you can thank Brad Carson for surprisingly resurrecting it from the dead. However, what I want to suggest is the problem is really not unique to philosophy, and in fact, it extends to most of the humanities. Should we study poetry to produce scholarship? Or might the poet himself have a place in the university, even though he's not producing that? If he's not producing scholarship, what is his value? Why should young people seek to produce scholarship in classics, literature, or history? If what the university doles out is credentialed expertise, then I think the humanities are always going to appear as kind of quirky boutique options. It's okay for the weirdos, but it's never going to make it big. And I also think that most professors today would scoff at the idea that reading Dante or Homer might develop students on a deeper, more fundamental level. And I think the echoes of Weber are really apparent in that attitude or posture, right? The professor is a scholar, and all this talk of higher study as a cultivation of the soul is embarrassing. It reeks of the charlatan. Meanwhile, I would like to note that the humanities are dying everywhere. Perhaps these things are related, who can say? Okay, so now I want to talk about Newman, who's my hero. Okay, we will only feel the force of Weber's conception of this ideal of university knowledge if we accept his account of just disenchantment as a very powerful sociological, cultural, and historical process that simply cannot be resisted. Like, disenchantment is just going to run over you. And while I think we can see the forces of disenchantment all around us, I would also suggest that it operates imperfectly and in competition with other forces that temper it, such as the truth. Furthermore, we are not merely passive subjects of sociological, cultural, and economic forces. We are agents. We do have the ability to think and act as individuals and as a political collective. And if we see negative effects and implications of disenchantment, we can and should fight back in various ways against it. We don't have to accept Weber's famous fact-value distinction. Indeed, I've produced a lot of scholarship arguing that it's completely false, but I will save that for a different lecture. But to be agents of change, we have to articulate and advocate for a credible alternative to the Weberian ideal. And here I think we find the resources for constructing an alternative model in John Henry Newman's famous set of lectures on the university called The Idea of a University. So Newman's Idea of a University is written in 1852. This is 12 years before Weber was even born. In these lectures, Newman advocates for the idea of a university that is primarily focused on teaching the liberal arts, with the understanding that liberal arts are those arts undertaken for their own sake, and that bring about the habits of mind that prepare young people to be free, right, in a sense of interior freedom, the freedom to know what is good and true and beautiful, and to try to orient oneself and one's life accordingly. For Newman, a university is concerned, first and foremost, not with the advancement of knowledge, although he's not at all against that, but its diffusion and extension. He is interested in formation primarily and the production of knowledge secondarily. Now, Newman's definition of a university, it's really important to be clear, has nothing essentially to do with either Christianity or the church. This is Newman's definition of a university. It is an institution dedicated to seeking and teaching universal knowledge. That's what it is. Universities seek and teach universal knowledge. Now, most of the second lecture of The Idea of a University is devoted to the explication of this sort of knowledge. What is that? What is universal knowledge? So Newman is most concerned that the university be a place where the whole of liberal knowledge is represented. It's not simply that no part of the knowledge can be omitted, but that this knowledge needs to form a whole or comprehended as a unity, right? So like Weber, Newman speaks of knowledge in terms of facts, but unlike Weber, he thinks we can know facts beyond what strictly quantitative and empirical methods might offer up. He thinks we can have knowledge through intuition, through testimony, through abstract reasoning, from principles, etc. But whatever licit means we come to, right, to have knowledge, it will fit, Newman insists, into a larger system or unified account of what can be known. And he calls that reality, or the universe. So here's Newman. I'm quoting him. Truth is the object of knowledge of whatever kind. And when we inquire what is meant by truth, I suppose it is right to answer that truth means facts and their relations, which stand towards each other pretty much as subjects and predicates in logic. All that exists, as can be contemplated by the human mind, forms one large system or complex fact, and this, of course, resolves itself into an indefinite number of particular facts, which, as being portions of a whole, have countless relations of every kind, one towards another. So truth is not just grasping facts or making true assertions, but understanding facts in relation to one another as a totality, as part of a comprehensive system, and with an understanding of an account of those relations. Now, Newman is also working with a concept of progress and knowledge, but it's very different from Weber's. So by contrast with Weber, Newman thinks that in making advances, right, in knowledge, we're seeing how the parts of truth relate to that greater whole of truth. And behind this idea of truth is a conception of the universe, the totality of being or reality, as something that's intrinsically intelligible or knowable through principles, right? It's something, if it exists, right, then Newman thinks it has to be the case that we can know it. And for Newman, and this is really the key point for him, there can be no university without a universe and universal knowledge of that universe, at least as a regulative ideal towards which we're constantly progressing. Now, if we accept this model of universal knowledge as an ideal towards which the university ought to strive in all of its intellectual endeavors, then we can start to see how all the disciplines taught within the university ought, at least in principle, to try to bear upon one another. So Newman argues that the various sciences arrange and classify facts, reduce separate phenomena under common principles, and trace effects to their causes. Inasmuch as sciences are forms of knowledge, they ought to be able to communicate with other sciences their results in order to contribute again to this universal knowledge. And it follows from this that each science then must understand itself to be incomplete without the other sciences in the university. And each must recognize the respects in which the other sciences are also contributing to the whole of universal knowledge. Right, so he has this vision where all departments have to understand themselves as making their own necessary but incomplete contributions to the whole of knowledge, where that whole is something that is consistent with itself, right? So no part of that whole is going to contradict any other part of that whole. And if we did find a contradiction, the thing that we would have to do is work to resolve it, right? And if you're a professor in such a university, you understand yourself not merely as seeking the truth within some very limited disciplinary methodology or perspective, but as doing that for the sake of something higher. That higher thing being what Newman calls universal knowledge or wisdom. For this reason, philosophy, the discipline which is especially concerned with the pursuit of wisdom, has a privileged position in Newman's ideal university, which is why I like it. Okay, so this is Newman again. The comprehension and the bearing of one science upon another and the use of each to each and the location and limitations and adjustment and due appreciation of them all, this belongs to a sort of science distinct from them all. And in some sense, a science of sciences, right? Which in my own conception is what is meant by philosophy in the true sense of the word and the cultivation of a philosophical habit of mind. So what Newman wants is for philosophical or universal knowledge, at some point in the argument, he uses them interchangeably, to be communicated within every university discipline, right? He wants nurses to have philosophical knowledge. He wants engineers to have philosophical knowledge. He wants physicists to have philosophical knowledge. And he wants this because he thinks we move towards philosophical knowledge of what we study only insofar as we can begin to see how the different disciplinary truths are related to one another, and how the truths they reveal form a unified body of knowledge that is, again, consistent with itself. And it follows from this that Newman thinks that all university professors need some training in philosophy, and all students do as well. Now, I want to turn to talk about what Newman says universal knowledge or wisdom is for, because this is where happiness, understood as complete human fulfillment rather than just like feeling good or being in a good mood, right? Happiness, understood as complete human fulfillment, enters the account. So Newman argues that the pursuit of universal knowledge helps to form habits of mind that are essential to living well as a person, really no matter what you're studying or what you do after graduation. And this is the greatest advantage, Newman thinks, of an institution that is truly devoted to liberal or universal learning. It comes down to the cultivation of habits of mind. So this is Newman again. Hence it is that this education is called liberal. For a habit of mind is formed over time, which lasts throughout the student's life, of which the attributes are freedom, calmness, moderation, and wisdom, what I have ventured to call the philosophical habit. This is the special and perfect fruit of the education furnished at a university. So Newman, sticking to the account of liberal arts that is first articulated in Aristotle's Politics, right? Aristotle, when he introduces this idea of liberal art, he says these are the arts that the person undertaking them seeks knowledge for its own sake and not for the sake of some separate end. So then, knowledge in that context is not about power or progress or control or domination of another person. It is about the fulfillment of human nature and human flourishing. And the contemplative habits of mind that a liberal education cultivates and instills is good without qualification because it contributes to human flourishing. How does it do that? So Aristotle says, well, it fulfills the natural human desire we have to know and understand. This is a desire that Aristotle called wonder. And he believes that wonder is the beginning of philosophy, right? It's just this desire to know and understand what is going on. It's this natural desire that is perfectly cultivated by a truly liberal education. And it is because a liberal education specifically directs this desire towards the most universal and highest objects of knowledge. It asks us not merely to seek the truth, but to ascend to the heights of wisdom, because our fulfillment as rational creatures depends on this upward movement, right? From particularity to the general and the universal. This is a view basically shared by everyone in sort of classical philosophy. And so that idea brings me back to the topic of theology, which, remember, is totally verboten in Weber's university. So Newman argued, and it's a really interesting argument, Newman argued that if we remove theology from the university, we prejudicially settle in advance the question of whether theology is a science that yields knowledge, right? We just settle that in advance. It's not. Even worse, he argued that the removal of theology would tear the very fabric of knowledge into tattered and disunified threads. And of course, by theology, Newman meant the science of God, understood as the truths we know about God put into a coherent system. Now, part of his argument is that this understanding of the importance of theology was long the inheritance of the West in both Athens and Jerusalem. So I think we do well to remember that theology was the alternative name that Aristotle gave to his metaphysics, which sought to understand being qua being. This was wisdom in the Greek sense of Sophia, because nothing is more universal and common than existence itself. And Aristotle argued from reason that there must be a ground to existence, and he gave that ground the name of God, and he devoted metaphysics to the study of that. Metaphysics, as the science of wisdom, was ultimately directed to the highest object of study. Well, what's going to perfect your intellect except the highest object of study, right? Like, what is the most universal thing you could know? Now, Newman's definition of theology is really close to Aquinas's, although Thomas calls it sacra doctrina, right? Or sacred teaching. Aquinas is clear that the first principles of theology are the articles of faith, which are a matter of revelation, not reason. Theology contains truths that surpass or exceed human reason, and thus it is necessary that besides philosophical science, there should be a sacred science learned through principles of revelation. While there's a kind of philosophical theology demonstrated by Aristotle and others, Aquinas opens the Summa Theologiae by announcing that he is doing something else, which is interesting because the very next question in the Summa is just like straightforward reasoning to God's existence without revelation. So there's lots of philosophy in the Summa too, but only done within the context of what he's calling sacra doctrina. Now, Thomas is keen to argue that sacra doctrina is a legitimate science. Indeed, it is the highest and most noble science, as its first principles come from God's self-revelation to man rather than man's own reason. It is a science that considers things under the aspect of being divinely revealed. It's the noblest science in virtue of its object. God is the worthiest object of our study because God is the beginning and final end of man. Aquinas recognizes wisdom in all forms of scientific study, and he further recognizes wisdom as a gift of the Holy Spirit that allows a man to pursue all things in relation to divine truth. He also recognizes wisdom as a specific literary tradition within the Bible. But since we are discussing the university, I just want to stick to the wisdom that comes from study. And that, of course, he associates with theology and to a lesser extent, philosophy. So I want to try to put Aquinas and Newman together here at the end. For both, there is wisdom to be sought within any university discipline, so long as we ground the discipline in forms of philosophical or universal knowledge. In principle, both hold out the promise that there can be wise engineers, poets, computer scientists, or sociologists. The key is to have the philosophical habit of mind as one advances within one's disciplinary bounds and keeps an eye out for the wider horizons of what Newman calls the universe. For it's this wider horizon that leads us to contemplate the ultimate things and, of course, our ultimate end. And however we settle those questions, we cannot really know how to live until we address them. And both of them think that you ought to address them in the university. So it follows from this, I think, that disciplinary knowledge must have an ineliminable liberal foundation. This is like kind of my key takeaway from Newman. So that when we think of general education, that which every university student has to study, we ought always to be thinking of liberal education, the sort of education that can be pursued for its own sake and instill the habits of mind that are necessary for specialized knowledge to be at its best in service of the higher knowledge of wisdom. Now, a merely technocratic approach to education, which I think is very much ascendant in the university today, understands itself as a training for a life of work, whether that's the intellectual work of the scholar or the practical work of the engineer, it doesn't matter. It's just a training for a specific line of work. Now, while such an education is important, a university education, on Newman's account, cannot be reduced to this and remain higher in any deep or meaningful sense that distinguishes the university from a trade school. In its essence, higher education concerns the cultivation of the human mind so that students can become free. A truly free person knows what is true, good, and beautiful, and is free to realize his own potential as a human being and flourish. He's able to think about technological progress in terms of whether or not it advances what is good and beautiful or whether it destroys it. The liberal arts are ordered to the cultivation of this kind of interior freedom. How so, right? Well, I think the way that this operates is that it's orienting you to ask those questions of ultimate meaning and purpose that Weber sort of says, well, that's just beneath the university, or that's something that you do on your own time. So I'm at the end of my talk, I promise. But I want to return to this question with which I began. Is wisdom only for the philosopher, or even that rarer creature, the theologian? Or should all university students seek wisdom? To seek wisdom is to want to ascend to the heights of our ability to know, to seek the highest and most universal objects that bear on human happiness. It is to seek answers to the questions that Weber pushed out and marginalized. How should I live? What is beautiful? For what may I hope? What might actually make my life meaningful and complete? For Weber, those are questions you should work out on your own time, and academics and universities can't be bothered with it. But if we want to hold on to the ideal of liberal education, which I do, then we have to ascend to those heights and to search out answers for ourselves so that we can, in a deep way, take charge of our own lives and societies. If the university gives up on this sort of education, which by and large I believe that it has, it tells us that study is irrelevant to the good life or the good society, that this is a matter for someone else. Surely this is a way of disaster and dystopia. I believe that it would not at all be inappropriate for all students to study what some of the best theologians have had to say about the meaning of things. But certainly, it would be difficult to approach these questions without forming what Newman called the philosophical habit of mind, which is best procured not just by reading, but by actually doing philosophy in a seminar with others who understand the value of doing it as well. And while you are at it, I believe that students should experience, read, and recite some poetry, great literature, and history. Because the wisdom of the entire classical tradition tells us that your freedom and your happiness are what is at stake in such liberal study, and I hope that you will never lose sight of that. Thanks for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.